before. It was a very difficult endeavor to turn a surface-to-air missile into an air-to-air rocket.
The IRGC's army units have been divided into 32 parts, two for Tehran province and one for every other province, to effectively maintain domestic security of the country in peacetime. Mr. Khoshchashm is a senior political analyst and familiar face on Press TV. He joined us on Skype this time.
Considering that Iran is located in a region which is not secure and probably one of the very few countries that you may experience established security in this country, it shows pretty well how it's been successful, how much it's been successful, especially considering that there have been enemies for this country like Israel, the United States, and Daesh or the ISIS that have declared time and again that they mean to undermine security of Iran, and the security that we enjoy today in the country is very much indebted to the IRGC and its security apparatus that have been very much successful.
The 18,000-man Navy of the Atesh is charged with the responsibility of forming the first line of defense in the Sea of Oman and beyond, basically our southern waters. It is capable of operating in the northwest quarter of the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, and even in the Atlantic Ocean. Meanwhile, the IRGC's Navy has steadily improved its capabilities to support unconventional warfare and defend Iran's offshore facilities, coastlines, and islands in the Persian Gulf.
In several cases, when they were assisting some vessels that were smuggling fuel in the past several years, there have been standoffs between the two sides. And the Americans have been trying to help these fuel smugglers. The IRGC Navy has been successful in exercising law and pushing back the Americans to protect interests of the country and to arrest these vessels, seize these vessels, and bring them to law in Iran. Also, there have been several scenes of confrontations when the U.S. Intended to violate the Iranian territorial waters, considering that the U.S. has probably the most powerful naval force in the world. They were expected to, make some kind of scenery and to embrace success probably, but they've been defeated in all such scenes and confrontations in the past few decades, at least in the last 10, 20 years, ever since the Iranian IRGC naval forces, the speedboats, started, very tough missions in the waterway.
The Air Force of the Artesh, with 37,000 personnel, is charged with the responsibility of defending Iranian airspace. It relies largely on inherited U.S.-supplied aircraft that have been refurbished with the most advanced modern equipment by Iranian engineers. Another surprising point of comparison brings out an Iranian superiority to countries it has later on bought jets from.
There are many aircraft manufacturers in the world. Many countries are making aircraft, but not so many make flight simulators. We started off by making repairs and upgrades to the fighters and then built simulators. I remember that before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, they had imported a simulator for an easy maintenance F-5, but it wasn't even unboxed. That was where things were kicked off. After the revolution, my colleagues went through the difficult unboxing and initiation process for the device. Running a simulator is harder than operating a plane. I followed the matter and conducted flights on it.
The Air Defense Force was established in February 2008 for sharper focus on Iran's deterrent doctrine. With 15,000 personnel, the force operates Air Force radars, anti-aircraft guns, and a variety of Russian, Chinese, British, and U.S. surface-to-air missile systems acquired before and after the 1979 revolution. Iran has also deployed its own domestically manufactured missile systems.
We began manufacturing arms from the moment the war started. Take mortars, for example, which are simple weapons. We were under sanctions, so people at the IRGC tried to build the most basic form of mortars out of water pipes. Those who were tasked with building such weapons later managed to produce long-range precision-guided missiles. That was the result of depending on the internal capacities and abilities of the Iranian youth that creates such internally driven changes.
The IRGC seems to be in possession of Iran's medium-range ballistic missiles, including Sejil-2, which makes up the strategic arm of Iran's air power and its primary deterrent. There's plenty more to come, but only after a quick diversion into global media. Here's what other media outlets said. The Middle East Eye quotes Iran's Quds Force leader Ghani, who replaced the martyred Soleimani. He vowed to continue backing militias across the region. The head of Iran's Quds Force, an elite branch of the country's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, vowed to continue leading militias across the Middle East amid stalled hopes for a nuclear deal with the West. Speaking to supporters and senior commanders of the Corps, Brigadier General Esmail Ghani said all Islamic militias would undoubtedly enjoy Iran's backing and took aim at the U.S. and Israel. The U.S. and Zionists should know that this is our definite path, he said. The Islamic Revolution of Iran knows how to guide young, motivated Muslims to defend themselves. Our hands are not tied, and we will respond robustly wherever in the world our interests come under aggression, Ghani said. Tasnim News reads, Army chief warns of Iran's intense response to threats. Commander of the Iranian Army, Major General Abdurrahim Mousavi, reminded enemies that their strategic depth is within reach of Iran, warning that any threat to the Islamic Republic will be met with great force. In a message released on the occasion of National Army Day, Major General Mousavi warned enemies that any action against Iran will cost them dearly. The enemy should bear in mind that its strategic depth is within reach of Iran's military equipment and clout, the commander added. He said the Iranian army has gained considerable experience of real battle under all geographical conditions, stressing that it will respond to any threat with the highest degree of power. In 2019, the U.S. State Department designated the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, as a terrorist organization, an unprecedented action against the military of a sovereign state. In response, Iran has sanctioned United States former President Donald Trump and 9 other senior officials of his administration. The individuals were blacklisted for their role and participation in terrorist and anti-human rights acts against the Islamic Republic of Iran and Iranian nationals.
The main reason why the IRGC is under sanction goes back to the impact it has had on strengthening Iran's military and deterrence power. If it wasn't for the army and the IRGC, the U.S. would seek a regime change in Iran. They have admitted to it several times.
Now, one of the remaining final issues in the Iran nuclear negotiations in Vienna to lift sanctions and perhaps revive the Iran nuclear deal, JCPOA, has been the Iranian demand that the IRGC be taken off the U.S. list of foreign terrorist organizations. Last January, Iran's judiciary announced it had requested an Interpol red notice for former President Trump and 47 other U.S. officials who had played a part in the assassination of General Soleimani. Iran has not been able to import large arms consignments due to the multitude of imposed sanctions. Instead, this country has made efforts to produce or assemble its own weapons at home. The government popularized the idea of moving towards self-sufficiency in arms production. Unable to import, Iran has chosen an affordable and shortcut approach to develop a deterrent capability by investing and focusing on its missile industry through assembly, modification, and reverse engineering of imported weapons. Well, once imported weapons. In other words, replacing conventional forces with less clout before a powerful enemy with asymmetric forces, more powerful due to their use of cunning and asymmetric methods. That said, and at least in comparison to its immediate neighbors, Iran's armed forces remain a major conventional power in the Persian Gulf and West Asia region.
Following the assassination of General Soleimani, we conducted a retaliatory operation and struck the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq, housing U.S. troops with a missile attack. The missile strike left the Americans helpless. Firstly, they couldn't intercept it, and secondly, it was so accurate that General McKenzie, former CENTCOM commander, said on many occasions that they can't do anything in the face of Iranian missiles.
Iran's military doctrine and strategy is primarily defensive, and so Tehran does not seek military confrontation. Accordingly, the Islamic Republic primarily employs its unconventional capabilities and allies to maintain its overall regional interest. After World War II till the end of the Pahlavi era, advisors from France, England, Austria, and later on from Italy and Sweden made it to Iran for modernization of economic, military, and social systems. The American board's presence in Iran was more conspicuous since Iran's dependence and supporting the Shah had been their main objective. Therefore, with the victory of the revolution in 1979, all foreign advisors to the army left the country and abandoned all their projects. As a result, the Iranian nation was left with very extensive and expensive military equipment, not knowing how to utilize or maintain it without the support of the departed foreign advisors.
It's a difficult task. There are guidelines and books on it. We didn't do such overhauls. They had recently brought in the aircraft and were expected to do it by themselves. That was the case with all the aircraft. Passenger and cargo planes like the 747 were taken to Pakistan to undergo overhauls. But we got to a point where we'd overhaul all types of airplanes in the Mehrabad airport under my watch as its head. We'd disassemble and reassemble them. I believe we've overhauled a dozen types of airplanes, including the 747.
Faced with this situation, the late Imam Khomeini stressed the need for self-sufficiency and localizing military equipment production and maintenance. He did once state that not only now, but also as long as Iranians stand by the revolution, the hegemonic powers will not sell any advanced arms to Iran or offer any help. Today, after more than four decades, this order by the Imam has borne fruit and Iran has towed a very successful path, and it is currently enjoying self-sufficiency and self-reliance in the defense and military equipment industry. At the moment, the country is keeping up with the world's latest technologies in the design and manufacture of destroyers, radars, cannons, missiles, and anti-cruise ships. Furthermore, Iran is ready to supply neighboring and friendly states with its state-of-the-art scientific and military technologies. For example, Iran could also sell its highly capable unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs. According to the Iranian press, Russia has already expressed its intention to buy Iranian drones, although it is likely that the Kremlin would try to acquire a license to produce them locally.
It forced the country to develop its homegrown arms program. Ever since then, Iran has developed even a new doctrine, which is very much based on its missile power. The advancement that Iran made in its missile industries encouraged the country to make similar advancements in other areas of arms production, manufacturing, and development, including drone technology. Iran is one of the top five in area of drone and missile industries and power in the world. The same is true about other weapon systems, defense shields, as well as many other arms, light arms, and heavy machine guns.
The Iranian defense industry could also offer services such as maintenance and modernization packages. Iranian engineers have demonstrated impressive skills in keeping aging platforms operational. According to experts, they are also the driving force behind the technological achievements of some knowledge-based companies in Iran. That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the weeks after the 2020 presidential election, as Donald Trump and his supporters claimed the results had been tainted by fraud, secretaries of state in key battleground states became the target of intimidation and threats. Now the former president is using the power of his endorsement to wield influence in the races for those posts. We now present you an article written by Joanne Grieve. The piece is titled Arsonists with Keys to the Firehouse, Once Obscure State Races Fuel Fears for US Democracy. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Last year, Brad Raffensperger was attracting national headlines for taking a stand against former US President Donald Trump and his lies about the 2020 presidential election. In a phone call that was quickly made public, Trump demanded that Raffensperger, Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, find enough votes to deprive Joe Biden of a victory in the battleground state. Brad Raffensperger refused to do so, and won widespread praise for his courage. Raffensperger is paying for his actions in a way that reveals how his once obscure elected position is now at the center of a battle for the future of American democracy, and attracting all the big money and political heat that entails. This year, Brad Raffensperger is facing a brutal primary race against a Donald Trump-backed candidate, the U.S. Congressman Jody Heiss, and trying to cling on to his job. Jody Heiss, who has said the 2020 results in Georgia would have been different if the race had been fair, has already raised more than twice as much money as Raffensperger. Jody Heiss's impressive haul is partly thanks to the unusually high number of out-of-state donations that his campaign has attracted, as more Americans across the country zero in on Secretary of State races. And Georgia is not unique. As Donald Trump and his allies continue to spread the big lie of widespread election fraud in the 2020 race, many voters are focusing their attention and their wallets on the officials who oversee state's elections. Secretary of State candidates in both parties are now posting substantial fundraising figures, intensifying concerns over how election administration has become a heated political issue in the United States. We'll be right back. Secretary of State races have historically attracted little notice and even less money. The winners of these elections assume rather bureaucratic roles, and their duties may include managing state records, overseeing the Department of Motor Vehicles, and keeping the state seal. But in many states, the Secretary of State also serves, crucially, as the chief election official. In the weeks after the 2020 presidential election, as Donald Trump and his supporters claimed the results had been tainted by fraud, secretaries of state in key battleground states became the target of intimidation and threats. Now the former president is using the power of his endorsement to wield influence in the races for those posts. While Donald Trump did not endorse any candidates for Secretary of State in 2020, he has already endorsed three in the 2022 cycle: Jody Heiss in Georgia, Mark Fincham in Arizona, and Christina Caramo in Michigan. All three candidates have embraced the lie that Democrats stole the 2020 election by allowing fraud to affect the results. Joe Biden's margin of victory in each of those states was less than 3 percentage points, and their input could prove decisive in the next presidential election. Kim Rogers, executive director of Democratic Association of Secretaries of State, said, "They are willing to overturn the will of the voters in order to choose the winner. It is disempowering, and it is akin to giving an arsonist keys to the firehouse." Republicans and Democrats' disparate concerns over election fairness have contributed to a significant increase in donations to Secretary of State candidates. According to an analysis by the Brennan Center for Justice, donations for Secretary of State races in six battleground states are three times higher than they were at this point in the last election cycle in 2018, and eight times higher than the 2014 cycle. Fundraising has particularly increased in Arizona, Georgia, and Michigan, which also happen to be the three states where Donald Trump has issued an endorsement. Ian Wender Walker, senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Elections and Government Program, said, "A lot more money is going to these once sleepy bureaucratic races. The places that we've seen the biggest increase, which is basically Arizona, Georgia, and Michigan, each of those places had some degree of nationally covered election controversy around the 2020 presidential election." The Brennan Center analysis also indicated that out-of-state donations to Secretary of State candidates are increasing at an even faster rate than overall donations. Fincham, who has called on the Arizona legislature to decertify the 2020 presidential results in three major counties, already has six times as many donors as every Secretary of State candidate in the 2018 election combined. Two-thirds of those donors live outside of Arizona. Democrats have taken note of Republican enthusiasm about Secretary of State elections, and they're responding by ramping up their own fundraising. The Democratic Association of Secretaries of State and its partner groups raised a record $4.5 million in 2021, compared with $1.5 million raised during the entire 2018 cycle. The organization has said it is on track to meet the fundraising goal of $15 million for the 2022 cycle, in part because of the increase in first-time individual donors. Other progressive groups, including End Citizens United and iVote, have pledged to spend tens of millions of dollars more on Secretary of State races this year. Kim Rogers, executive director of the Democratic Association of Secretaries of State, said, "The engagement is at every single level. We have seen a massive increase in our email list and grassroots support." Kim Rogers believes Democratic activists are increasingly turning their attention to Secretary of State races, partly because they have been frustrated by the lack of progress at the federal level. Congressional Democrats have repeatedly tried to pass national voting rights legislation, which would reverse some of the voting restrictions enacted by 19 states last year. But Senate Republicans have successfully used the filibuster to defeat those bills. Kim Rogers said, "I think there are a lot of activists who got involved in 2020 who fought incredibly hard for the federal voting rights legislation in 2021. Rogers added, "When 50 Republicans blocked it yet again, folks were looking for a way to stay engaged and to continue the fight, and they shifted their assets into the states." Republicans complain that Democrats are trying to alter election regulations to their benefit at both the federal and state levels. Andrew Romeo, communications director for the Republican State Leadership Committee, said Democrats were ramping up their interest in Secretary of State races because they see control of these offices as a way to change the rules to compensate for their inability to win elections. Andrew Romeo's group is an umbrella organization that promotes Republican candidates for state legislatures, state Supreme Courts, and Secretary of State offices, among other roles. The Republican State Leadership Committee and its policy partner group raised $33.3 million in 2021, exceeding their previous odd-year record by more than $14 million. But to Democrats like Kim Rogers, the outcome of Secretary of State races in key battleground states represents nothing less than the fate of American democracy. Kim Rogers said, "These folks want to rig the game, and they're out to do that." Ian Vander Walker, senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Elections and Government Program, fears that the increasingly dire messaging about Secretary of State races will contribute to a political climate in which both political parties distrust the outcome of the elections. Ian Vander Walker added, "Money and attention being paid to these races is not inherently a bad thing. The voters should be informed about these candidates. That kind of rhetoric is extremely dangerous to voter confidence because, of course, one side or the other is going to win and is going to count the votes. And democracy counts on people accepting the result, even if their side doesn't win."
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
The working conditions at American giant retail company Amazon have been subject to a myriad of complaints by the employees. Complaints initially gained national and international attention because of the too few bathroom breaks inhumanely imposed on Amazon staff and drivers in an attempt to maximize productivity and speedy delivery of goods to customers. It was indeed a blatant attempt to boost profits for the owners of the company, most notably its owner and executive chairman, Jeff Bezos, one of the richest men in the world, whose net worth has now exceeded $180 billion U.S. dollars.
Amazon Labor Union.
Hello and welcome to We the People, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in today's episode, we'll investigate the working conditions for the average worker at Amazon, which is reported to be often tough and occasionally unsafe. While Amazon shareholders and customers are mostly happy with the retail giant, the workers, such as those in the warehouses, often have a very different experience. For years, the workers have been making effort to improve the situation, but have not managed to bring about any real change as Amazon keeps suppressing any voices of dissent via its powerful means of crackdown. In today's episode, we'll be joined by Lauren Steiner with a robust opposition to delve deeper into the issue and what could be done about it. And later, we'll be joined by Eric Ramos, union iron worker, mutual aid organizer, and member of the Communist Party USA from Chicago. Stay with us.
Workers in warehouses are tracked with a computer algorithm rather than being reported or written up by any superintendents. Therefore, they get no chance to do anything challenging to the system and are basically expected to perform like robots. Amazon has continued to track every minute of most warehouse workers' shifts, from how fast they pack merchandise to how long they pause.
Now, many have drawn attention to the highly questionable way that Amazon's computerized system hires, monitors, and fires workers based on performance at the service of profit, rendering a cruel juggernaut with no mercy or understanding of real human needs. So is Amazon capitalizing on its workforce to make increasingly greater profits by pressuring employees through measures such as cutting their break times?
Well, I first learned about unfair conditions Amazon warehouses when I lived in Los Angeles. Many of them were not properly cooled and workers were collapsing from heat exhaustion. The other thing that was famously reported is that they have so much that they have to produce. They don't have time to take bathroom breaks and they were peeing in bottles. I know Chris Smalls started his walkout because they during the pandemic, they weren't following proper safety procedures. There was not enough PPE, hand sanitizers. They weren't doing proper social distancing. A lot of service workers, restaurant workers, for instance, the Starbucks workers, they don't get regular hours. They keep them below 30 hours a week, and they don't give them the schedule until a couple of days before the week begins, so they can't, you know, even get a second job.
The already dire conditions has worsened with the breakout of the coronavirus pandemic, which has made more and more Americans rely on the retail delivery service and consequently leading to a bigger workload for the warehouse workers and truck drivers. The employment machine has had to work increasingly harder, which has made the working conditions even more arduous.
Well, I think the workers need to, you know, start unions, which is what they're doing right now. I mean, that's really all they can do. I mean, people have complained to management before with no success. So starting a union is something that forces management to have to listen to them.
Now, as more residents have to rely on online shopping today, in part over fears of shopping in person, Amazon and its founder, Jeff Bezos, have used its complex and technologically advanced systems to assure the happiness of customers on the one side and to maximize profits for the corporation on the other. So is that going to change with the latest effort by workers in Staten Island? And how could the latest quest by Amazon employees to unionize be assessed?
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, when you hear from people on the ground, it was a big factor to them that basically this was an effort that was done by the workers themselves. You know, it was a big choice for them to start their own independent union, opposed to trying to gain representation through established unions. You know, for them, that meant that, I mean, it's a lot easier to trust them. it dismantles the rhetoric from corporations, and especially the campaign that Amazon was running, that basically says that that unions are a third party entity that get between the workers and the bosses, and that their goal is to, you know, gather as many members as possible to you know, basically just to get more dues, you know, so that the union itself can become richer.
Amazon's numerical understanding of the real people has led to unprecedented human suffering, which cannot be represented in numbers. With the sharp spike in demands due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the company has touted breathtaking job creation numbers, and from July to October 2020 alone, it managed to hire up 350,000 new workers.
Now, most of the Amazon workers are hired through computer screening and with no or little conversation with an interviewer. Now, it should come as no big surprise that the working conditions are very similar. What is next for the employees' efforts to make working conditions any better?
Well, I think that it's, as I said in the answer to the first question, I think that Amazon's success is going to be very inspirational. Chris Smalls said in a press conference the other day that 100 different Amazon stores have contacted him about, you know, starting unionization efforts. He's going to be on my show again. And I'm going to have on the people in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is where I live now. I live in North Carolina because they're trying to unionize their place of work. So I think it's just going to be a big multiplier.
Now, the bathroom breaks were just a tipping point of the dire working conditions at Amazon. And soon a trove of evidence and complaints appeared on U.S. news and media outlets involving just how workers' rights are being violated by the American multinational tech company.
So I think one of the biggest things to talk about is this thing called TOT. It means time off pay. So basically, all the employees are closely monitored to determine like how much time is spent not doing their assigned tasks. This doesn't mean like it's not just like talking to each other. It's not just checking your phone. It's I'm going to the bathroom or going to get a drink of water. And if this time builds up, they can actually be fired for it for having built up enough time off tasks.
Just recently, Amazon workers at the Staten Island facility voted by a wide margin to form a union, despite all the pressure imposed on them by the men on top. The measure has been described as a revolution at the company, which has so far spared no efforts to crack down on the smallest of attempts by the workers to unionize. Generally speaking, what are the issues workers in big companies such as Amazon are facing, and what should be done to address those issues?
We have this thing in this country where so many workers are like the workers there who are basically getting a minimum wage rates. And, you know, most workers don't want to organize because they're afraid they'll just get fired. Or if they put in a lot of time in a company, you know, it hurts. They don't necessarily want to leave, but a lot of the time they'll just be like, well, it pays the same at other places. So they'll just quit and get a job somewhere else. And I think that more and more workers are starting to see that, you know, that's just a problem, that conditions are going to be the same everywhere you go. So fortunately, we've seen, you know, I think that a lot of workers are going to be inspired by the ALU, the Amazon Labor Union, and see that, you know, it can be done. And I mean, hopefully we're not just going to see more Amazon warehouses start to organize in the same way, but also across industries just like it, you know.
Now, the company, which focuses on e-commerce, cloud computing, digital streaming, and artificial intelligence, among other things, is just one of many corporations in America which seeks to gain as much as profit as possible, even if it means imposing ever-grueling regulations on its workers. Now, the workers are naturally from the working class and struggle to survive in the capitalistic economy of America.
These different sectors are being used against each other. As far as for, you know, workers in general, everyone feels the squeeze, like I said. Everyone is expected to work longer hours for less pay and less benefits. You know, they're seeing that their money is not going as far as it was year after year when they are getting raises. And, you know, it's just, it's crazy. It's almost like, it's reminiscent of how it was 100 years ago in the previous American labor movement, you know. People working longer hours for less pay, and people are finally getting sick of it, you know. Yeah.
For years, the American workers have been striving to raise the minimum wage, yet mostly to no avail. Currently, the federal minimum wage for covered non-exempt employees is $7.25 per hour, which many workers deem to be way below what they need to cover the expenses of their livelihood. For long, American workers have been demanding a higher minimum wage. But are those demands going to materialize?
Well, the minimum wage hasn't been raised in many years. And in California, it was raised a few years ago to $15 an hour. And it was done gradually. So only now in 2022 did it become $15 an hour. But of course, in California, $15 an hour is too low of a minimum wage. It's not even a living wage. And here in Asheville, North Carolina, where I live, you know, the state minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. And they've determined that the living wage in Asheville here is $17.70 an hour. So, and this is a smaller city. This is not Los Angeles or New York. And they don't have unions here. It's a right to work state.
Meanwhile, Jeff Bezos has said that he is proud of the company's work culture, productivity goals, as well as the pay and benefits. He is not alone. The work culture in America's huge corporations is designed by the wealthy 1% owners to make sure that they can make more and more money at the cost of ruining everyone else's lives.
My son works these minimum wage jobs. The last employer he had, if they weren't busy, they would send him home, and of course they wouldn't pay him for these hours. So this is what they call precarity. It's a very precarious workplace, and they don't have a lot of rights. Now, you know, in the 50s, 30% of the American workforce was unionized. Now it's just 10%, and 6% of private employers' workforce is unionized. So they just don't have a lot of power. And that creates, that's one of the major causes for income inequality in this country.
So the men in power, they seek to provide as little wages and protection as possible and put the company's goals way above their workers' livelihoods. That has created fewer reliable jobs, more temporary work arrangements, declining wages, and ever-increasing high-stress conditions for the working class in the United States.
The thing is that, you know, real wage is a number in economics used to kind of measure how much wages, you know, how much buying power generally wages have. And that's a number we've seen constantly decreasing over the decades and remaining stagnant. Even though some places have been able to increase their wages, you know, we see that corporations continue to impose higher prices on society in general, which continues to raise the cost of living for everyone. Even people like myself who work in unions, and, you know, unions are often able to negotiate a 3% increase in wages to keep up with this. It hasn't been enough either.
It's not easy to keep working at Amazon, so workers keep quitting their jobs due to the impossible demands from the corporation's algorithm, with a turnover among the workforce roughly standing at 150% a year. Capitalizing on the workforce to make increasingly greater profits is not a novel phenomenon in America. Indeed, many experts believe that is what America and capitalism in general have been founded upon.
There was the PRO Act, which was a very important bill that was introduced last year that was passed by the House. And of course, the Senate won't pass it because, you know, it wouldn't, even if it got all Democrats voting for it, it wouldn't survive the filibuster. And the PRO Act would have outlawed anti-union meetings. It would enact federal financial penalties for threatening or firing workers, and it would help wrongfully terminated workers win reinstatement. So while that PRO Act did not pass, the National Labor Relations Board just issued a memo saying that companies can't have these anti-union meetings.
Some experts believe that the quality of life is increasingly lowering, and the biggest issue facing the American economy and political system is a gradual descent of the middle class into proletarian status. Now, since the 1970s, this process has been going on intermittently and has worsened considerably in recent years.
Our government is essentially, you know, bought by these corporations. The only thing that's ever really been effective is workers organizing in this way. And, you know, it's great to see that it's finally happening. I think we're seeing a resurgence of the labor movements here. I think they're going to have to do what's always worked, which is, you know, organizing and starting these unionization efforts and hopefully building across different lines of the entire American workforce to ultimately, I think that they'll have to build a political arm that actually represents them, that can actually enact a lot of the changes necessary to maintain the gains that they've made.
The way workers are treated in the U.S. keeps on increasing the inequality and injustice running rampant in the country. Enormous wealth is delivered to top executives and shareholders, while little is left for the people at the bottom. The dehumanizing manner in which Amazon conducts its business is spreading among other corporations, which would in part demand dangerously high production quotas likewise.
As long as the goalposts continue to get moved, as far as wages are concerned, you know, it's not gonna matter enough. It's not gonna be enough. What I think is gonna happen is that, you know, workers will succeed in getting wages increased, but we're likely gonna see the cost of living skyrocket in response. And I think that after that, you know, workers are gonna continue to see this. The facade of inflation is going to continue to thin. And they'll kind of realize that, once again, a political arm is going to be necessary for the labor movement in order to ensure that, you know, to ensure greater buying power.
In order to survive in the job market and to keep making ends meet, employees have to push harder to hit impracticable levels. They have to work harder and harder because they feel they're falling down on the job, as the demands by their employers are purposely designed to be unattainable for most workers. So whether or not efforts to unionize are going to change the situation for the better is yet to be seen. Now let's see what Abbas Montarim has prepared for us this week.
Huge victory happened for workers at the Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, New York, when the workers voted to unionize. It's arguably one of the biggest labor union victories in modern history. But what does this mean? What does it mean for the masses of workers? And what does it mean for the labor movement? On this episode of Power to the People, we will take a look at this recent labor victory and dive into what it means for workers' rights all across the world. But before we talk about this labor union victory, it's important that we look at some of Amazon's notorious inhumane work practices, whether it be wage theft, dangerous workplace conditions during the COVID-19 pandemic, which led to over 20,000 plus cases that we know of, as we know that Amazon was revealed to concealing the number of cases around workers testing positive. But not only that, Amazon has used mass surveillance on employees to make sure that they are working fast, and also have forced delivery drivers to have 14-hour days and no bathroom breaks. The list of inhumane practices go on and on, and we can literally do a whole segment on Amazon's inhumane practices. And these practices, they have made Jeff Bezos the second richest man in the world. Literally, while Jeff Bezos is on his yacht or taking excursions to space, workers are being exploited and being forced to pee in bottles because their work break isn't enough. This exploitation has led to attempts at unions to be founded throughout the country. And the first one to be successful is the establishment of the Amazon Labor Union, which was led by Chris Smalls, who used to work for Amazon, but he was fired as he led a protest against Amazon for the lack of COVID-19 safety measures in the warehouse. Smalls began organizing, and over a year after being fired, he successfully launched a campaign to unionize his former workplace. As the union, it captured 2,654 votes, while 2,131 votes were against it. The chickens truly came home to roost for Amazon and Jeff Bezos. And this undoubtedly, it's a historic win. Workers' rights at the warehouse should immediately improve, and it is a huge positive step for people working at that specific warehouse. But what is the full scope of the impact? Well, we are already seeing this victory being co-opted by the state. Bernie Sanders, a liberal Zionist, has been invited to speak with Chris Smalls, which in many ways exposes the lack of strong revolutionary ideology behind the movement. And this is something that workers' unions, they must address, which is a lack of revolutionary ideology. As we see a warehouse and Amazon unionizing, as well as we see a Starbucks shop unionizing, it might create a ripple effect amongst corporate workplaces throughout the world. And this will undoubtedly, it will undoubtedly improve American workers' conditions. But what does this mean for workers and colonized people across the world? These corporations aren't just here in America. They are global corporations and are a part of international finance capital that has been developed through imperialism. So while workers in America begin getting more rights and a welfare state under capitalism is expanded, these corporations, what is they gonna do? They just gonna extend their exploitation overseas and begin exploiting colonized people more than they already are to make up for the money lost due to unionization and workers getting more rights here in America. This is why it's important for workers' unions to have a revolutionary ideology. Workers' unions must fundamentally be anti-capitalist as well as anti-imperialist and must seek to end this parasitic system known as capitalism. Because what is an improvement? What is an improvement in working conditions here in America if we know that this American capitalist is going to go overseas to exploit other colonized people working in factories? And this is part of the evils of imperialism, and it's part of the evils of capitalism. And this is why unions must develop revolutionary internationalist stances that don't just focus on American workers. And throughout history, we've seen examples, whether it's the ILWU not allowing cargo from apartheid South Africa, as well as the ILWU not allowing cargo from Zionist Israel. We must understand that international solidarity is a must, and unions must develop international solidarity. This is Power to the People.
I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure to tune in next time when we return with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. One of the points that has been frequently mentioned in the prayers of this month, both day and night prayers, is the issue of asking God for forgiveness. We must ask God to forgive us. In certain prayers, there is a statement saying, "This is the month of forgiveness." Asking God for his forgiveness is frequently mentioned in these prayers. Well, What does forgiveness mean? It means apologizing. We must apologize to God the Exalted. We must apologize to Him for many things that we did and that we did not do. This act of asking for divine forgiveness, which is done with a pure intention, gives you a purity that attracts divine mercy. We must try to attract divine mercy and divine blessings. In prayers, we read, O God, I ask you to bring about the circumstances for your mercy. There are certain circumstances which lead to divine mercy. This asking for forgiveness is effective in all areas of life.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is an ayah, a verse, in Surah Al-Hud, in chapter Hud, about the command affairs of life. And O my people, ask forgiveness of your Lord, and turn to Him in repentance. He will send you the skies pouring abundant rain. In other words, God the Exalted shows heavenly blessings on you. After that, God says, and add strength to your strength. The Holy Quran, chapter 11, verse 52. This increases your strength and power. This is very important. This is not a personal matter. Rather, it is a public and national matter. The effect of asking for divine forgiveness in one of the most difficult arenas of life, fighting against the enemy, is more clearly explained in a holy ayah and verse in the auspicious Surah Al-Imran. How many of the prophets fought, and with them fought, large bands of godly men, but they never lost heart if they met with disaster in God's way, nor did they weaken, nor give in. And God loves those who are firm and steadfast. All they said was, Our Lord, forgive us our sins and anything. We may have done that, transgressed our duty. Holy Quran, chapter 3, verses 146 to 147.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For the first time since the onset of the COVID pandemic, hundreds of people of faith and none gathered in the shadow of North London's Finsbury Park Mosque to enjoy a breaking of the fast in a public setting. The iftar, backed by the local council and organised by Finsbury Park Mosque, Muslim Welfare House and British Muslim charity Islamic Relief, was an opportunity for the community to gather, celebrate and reflect.
It's good to show solidarity, Muslim, non-Muslim, Jews, Christian, all coming together to share a meal. This is a very powerful message that we are united, we are all at one despite our differences.
It's important because it's a very visible sign of the friendship and, you know, the togetherness that we have all through the year, actually. But and it's such lovely hospitality.
For me, it's an opportunity to, I suppose, show solidarity with my Muslim sisters and also